Joining us today, Congressman Ron Kind from the 3rd District. First of all, you're in an area that's kind of new to your district. Let's go back a little bit. It's a state issue with redistricting, but it definitely affected you. You lost St. Croix County, much of the northwestern area, and you gained much of central Wisconsin. How has that impacted you?
Well, let me tell you, first, I'm delighted to be here and excited to learn more about the community. Obviously, I'm setting up many meetings right now, getting to know the people, the leaders, the individuals around here. And, yeah, every 10 years we have a redistricting process because of the census being taken. The state legislature gets to draw the political map, and they decided to rearrange things a little bit. And I've always had a problem with politicians choosing their voters. It's supposed to work the other way around. The voters are supposed to decide who they want to represent them. And so I've been a big advocate of nonpartisan judicial commissions to draw the political map. And until Wisconsin goes in that direction, as other states have, we have what we have, and that's the state legislator getting to draw the map. But I couldn't be more delighted than to have this area. I'm excited and spent some time here already and looking forward to many repeat visits.
Have you found that the constituents are giving you the same issues, same worries and complaints here as you did in the northwestern part of the state?
You know, it's about the economy. What do we need to do to get our economy back on track, creating good-paying jobs? And there's a certain synergy right in this corridor, you know, from Wausau to Point to Rapids and that, and a lot of interesting, innovative things being done, which is going to be very exciting to be involved in. But that's the name of the game. A growing economy solves a lot of problems, budget-wise and otherwise. And to me, I think the greatest challenge we're facing right now as a nation is increased global competition. And how we respond to that is going to define who we are as a state and as a nation here in the 21st century, and especially what type of future our children have to look forward to. So we have some big decisions that have to be made, but to me it starts with listening to people back home here and getting their ideas and a good feel of what they're doing on the ground locally that we can build upon.
Is there anything going on in Congress at this point that may assist with getting some jobs going, getting maybe some training programs going that we haven't heard much about yet?
Yeah, you know, I've been involved with Bernie Patterson's initiative at Point, trying to develop the health care workforce needs in the area and throughout the state and the upper Midwest. That makes sense. It's a growth area. We have an aging population. Obviously, we have a lot of health care reform taking place right now, and it's one of those areas that I think there's going to be great need in. But I've also been a big advocate of the STEM studies, science, technology, engineering, math. You know, the seed corn we need to be planting as a nation to keep us as innovative and as competitive and creative as we can be as a nation. And I think we can do it. There are certain things that we have certain advantages of, but the rest of the world are making major investments in their education system, their job training, their infrastructure. We need to respond to that so we can stay on the cutting edge of new breakthroughs and new discoveries. And I've also been very much involved, too, as far as agriculture policy, given the important role that production agriculture has here throughout the state. It's still our number one industry, employing more people directly or indirectly. And we've got a farm bill right now that's pending in Washington. We need a new 5-year farm bill for our farmers to know what to expect and what to plan for. We had a tough drought year last year. Many people are predicting a continuation of drought conditions. So production agriculture is going to continue to face some challenges as we move forward.
Let's touch on that a little bit. The farm bill really got stalled, and many of us watching from the sidelines were kind of surprised that the farm bill, being as big and as important as it is, wasn't even mentioned for much sake in the last campaign until it was too late. Any idea why that might be?
Well, it was one of the big disappointments I had coming out of the last session of Congress. You know, the Senate finished the work. They moved a farm bill. They were waiting for the House of Representatives to do the same. But due to a variety of reasons, the House leadership refused to bring a bill to the floor, so it expired. And now we're just doing a continuing resolution on the current bill. But we need to make some changes. I've been one of the leading voices in Washington to change farm bill policy, to move away from these huge taxpayer subsidies that are going to big agribusiness. It hasn't benefited our family farmers back home. It's leading to greater consolidation in production agriculture, making it more difficult for new beginning farmers to enter the occupation when we need them now more than ever. And it hasn't been fiscally responsible. We just can't afford the billions of dollars in subsidies that are going out when we're wrestling with large budget deficits at the same time. So I'm hoping through this process right now of reauthorizing a new farm bill, we'll be able to get into many of those reform ideas that I've been an advocate for. while doing what we can to strengthen the conservation title. These are voluntary and incentive-based land and water conservation programs that farmers are asking for that can help reduce sediment and nutrient flows that affects the quality water habitat in the area. And let's face it, you know, outdoor recreation is a large part of our quality of life and of our economy in this region. And that's a key component in the Farm Bill, which farmers like, they appreciate, and it helps them be good stewards of their own land.
Just yesterday, I was at a different gathering where several hunters and waterfowl were concerned about a lack of a Farm Bill because of what it may do to habitat.
Yeah, you know, I was co-chair of the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus, so that was one of our priorities, is what do we need to do working together to strengthen the conservation title. I've been a huge hunter, fisherman, as a kid growing up in western Wisconsin myself, so I understand the value that that outdoor recreational opportunity bring, and the sporting community especially get it. I mean, some of the greatest conservationists I know are people who I hunt with and who I fish with, because they're out there and they understand the importance of preserving these precious resources, not only for our own use, but for future generations. And farmers, too, are great conservationists, but sometimes it's difficult for them to put good land management practices in place, getting the technical assistance that they need on their land, and that's what that title is meant to address. And we need to be strengthening these organizations so that they can do even a better job through public-private partnerships, which many of these programs are geared to set up, because they've been highly successful in the past. They're models that we should be continuing in the future. We just need to keep our priorities straight.
I understand the Rural Healthcare Coalition is one of your newest projects. What exactly is it, and how'd you get involved?
Well, it's a great group. It's a bipartisan group of about 130, 140 members that obviously have an interest in the quality and the access and the affordability of healthcare in rural communities. I have, in this congressional district, 17 critical access hospitals in rural communities. They face some unique challenges as far as recruitment and retention of good doctors and nurses and hospital personnel. And the people living in these communities have a right to have access to a quality healthcare system. But it's also a key component to economic development, because you're not going to get too many businesses locating an area that doesn't also offer quality health care services. So our group, and I'm co-chairing it with Kathy McMorris Rogers, a representative from Washington State, will meet periodically. We'll keep an eye on rural health care issues. We'll be their voice in Washington. We'll have a lot of meetings with them back home, as I do, traveling around the district, stopping in at rural providers and getting feedback from them. Because when budget decisions are made, you know, sometimes it's the bigger cities that carry a big voice, and the rural areas get short shrift. And this coalition is meant to guard against that. So people living in rural areas get a fair shake in Washington, too.
One of the criticisms we've heard about the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare, some call it, is that it'll drive some doctors right out of the practice. Is that something this group is watching?
Well, it is, and it's hopefully something we can avoid. Obviously, there's going to be a lot more emphasis on prevention and wellness programs, which means greater reliance on primary care physicians. Right now, we have a bit of a shortfall with primary care physicians. So in that legislation, we try to increase through bonus incentives, loan repayment programs, to get more medical students interested in primary care practices as opposed to specialty practices. We've got many of them. But that's it. I was one who supported health care reform because I felt that the status quo was unsustainable. You know, if we did nothing, we knew costs would increase, more uninsured would happen, our businesses would be less competitive because of rising health care costs. So we had to start experimenting with new ways of delivering medicine so it's more efficient. And especially, and this has been one of my primary focus, we have to change the way we pay for health care. So it's based on the value or the quality of care that's given and not the volume of services that are rendered. Right now, the payments are based on things that are done regardless of results. And that leads to overutilization, that leads to inefficient care. And a recent study just showed that we spent over $750 billion last year within the entire health care system on things that don't work. They don't improve patient care. So if we're going to ever get a grip on our budget deficits and getting our budgets under control, whether it's in Washington or Madison or back home here locally, rising health care costs is a big part of the answer on what we can do to get better value for the dollars we're spending.
Some would argue that hospitals and doctors do a lot of unnecessary testing or procedures just to make sure they don't miss something or save themselves. Is tort reform something that may be a part of this down the road?
Yeah, I think so. I think if we're going to be asking doctors to practice best medicine or protocols of care and establish checklists based on what we know works and what doesn't work, then they should be given greater safe havens for doing exactly that, so they don't have to order the extra test or practice defensive medicine. I think that is very fair and reasonable. But I'm also very encouraged to see that our providers in this area are establishing those models of care that are highly coordinated, they're integrated, they're patient-centered, getting some of the best results in the world. And these are the models that the rest of the healthcare system around the country needs to be striving for and driving for. And most healthcare experts, when they look around, they usually point back to Wisconsin and our healthcare providers and say, listen, if everyone throughout the country was doing what they're doing back in Wisconsin, we wouldn't have the type of healthcare mess that we have right now. So that is encouraging because it tells me we don't have to, A, recreate the wheel. Our healthcare providers in this area are showing us models of care that are more coordinated and therefore more efficient, and we just need the rest of the country to catch up with it.
While we're on the topic of healthcare, you've just introduced some new legislation concerning medical devices. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a medical device tax that will start going into effect later this year, and it'll have an adverse impact on our medical device manufacturers throughout the country, especially the smaller manufacturers, those who operate at a much smaller margin. And I think that was bad policy when it was first implemented. Eric Paulson from Minnesota and I just introduced legislation to repeal that medical device tax. The last thing we need to be doing is making it harder for companies to stay in business in Wisconsin or throughout the United States, creating the jobs we need. In a country as great as ours, we have to have the ability to make things and create things and grow things as a nation, along with the good-paying jobs that will come from it. And I think this tax that's going to apply will have detrimental effects on those manufacturers' ability to compete globally and for the smaller ones to stay in business. And some of the greatest cost savings that we've seen within the healthcare field have come from new innovations and new products being developed, which improves the quality of care that is being given. And so the last thing we want to do is make it more difficult for those innovators and those companies to do exactly that. So we introduced the legislation yesterday. We have close to 200 co-sponsors already. Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota introduced a companion bill in the Senate. And we will have to find an offset to replace the revenue that we wouldn't collect now from the device tax. But I think there are other areas of savings that we can look to first to make up the difference rather than taxing these manufacturers.
While we're getting into revenue and savings, the budget is a big problem at the federal level. And let's face it, the Senate hasn't put one out lately. The House has, but there's not a lot of House-wide agreement on that package. Where are we with the budget, and what types of cuts do you see coming, if any?
Well, first of all, these current budget deficits are unsustainable, and the answer to it is a long-term deficit reduction agreement that is bipartisan. That is the product of compromise. We have divided government, and therefore, by definition, it's going to require compromise, and both sides realizing they're not going to get everything that they want. And every bipartisan commission that's been formed to address the issue and come up with solutions have reached the same conclusion. We're going to need some additional revenue, but we're going to need major spending reforms, especially in the bigger spending categories, to really get a grip on our fiscal house and put it on a sustainable path. And the two largest spending programs we have right now in Washington is the health care programs, those rising health care costs, and it's also defense. And I think there are areas in defense spending we can look to for cost savings as well. Every year, it frustrates me to no end that the Pentagon submits a list of weapons programs that they tell Congress stop appropriating money for them because we don't want them. We don't need them. They won't help force readiness, and it's just a waste of money. Yet every year, Congress continues to appropriate money. And these are typically outdated Cold War relics that the Pentagon can't use because the threat we face is completely different from the Soviet threat of the 1950s or 1960s. So we have to have greater discipline and the courage to start saying no to more people when it comes to these budget decisions. But the biggest and the largest cost driver, again, is the health care programs. We have a rapidly aging population, 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day, entering Medicare, and that's why I've been so focused on health care reform and cost containment within the healthcare field. And I'm convinced that we can not only improve the quality of care for all Americans, but at a better price based on practices that we've seen here in Wisconsin and in some other areas of the country, but also by changing, again, the payment system. So it's value and not volume-based. If you change the incentives, you're going to change the behavior. And if you pay our providers based on outcomes rather than based on the more things they do, they're going to be focused on quality and outcomes. I mean, that's just natural.
Another thing to think about there is a lot of times a government entity will choose a single provider of a service. Wouldn't multiple providers make it more competitive, therefore more cost-effective?
Well, yeah, you're exactly right, Larry. We need more competitive bid out there. Competition's good. You know, we see that with medical equipment, for instance. We've got a pilot program taking place right now. It's 2 years in, and we're seeing substantial cost savings just through greater competition so that there's not a monopoly or anti-competitive situations created. And that could go a long ways, too. We have bulk rate purchasing right now as part of the healthcare reform, which allows hospitals to collaborate and purchase things in bulk, meaning substantial discounts in the products that they're purchasing, and those cost savings then are passed on. So there's a lot of innovation, a lot of new thinking happening in the healthcare field, which was long overdue because, again, the old system was unsustainable, and it was only going to lead to more uninsured, higher costs, crimping family and business budgets alike. So we need to continue this great experimentation in the healthcare field and learn what's working and what isn't. And then this is going to be the key. Make changes along the way with the Affordable Care Act, with the legislation that's been passed, because I never believed that with passage of that bill that was the end-all be-all of it. That was the end of the discussion. We have to keep an open mind and make adjustments along the way, and we have in certain instances already.
Energy policy is another big one, and the Keystone Pipeline, for example, has some supporters on both sides of the aisle. Where are you with that one?
Well, I think eventually the administration, the president, is going to sign off on it. You know, that oil is going to go somewhere. And one of the really neat and exciting stories of late has been the new energy finds that we've had in our own country, natural gas in particular. And right now, energy experts are predicting that we're on the path to energy self-sufficiency by 2020. This is a game changer. And the cheaper natural gas that's being produced right here at home is leading to cheaper business expenses, especially in the manufacturing field. And I've been talking to a lot of companies who in the past may have been thinking about moving jobs overseas because of cheaper labor, but because of transportation costs, but cheaper energy at home here, they're finding it more viable to stay right here. And that's a very good thing as far as future job creation. So we need to be able to sustain our energy production. And also what they're predicting is that the oil that we are going to be importing in 2020, the vast majority of that will come from Canada and Mexico and no longer from the Middle East. That, too, can be a tremendous game changer in that region that hasn't particularly been friendly to us. And maybe we can start pulling some of our aircraft fleets out of the Persian Gulf since we don't have to protect those supply lines over there anymore. So we need to be able to continue moving forward on this energy path, but also towards the eye of energy efficiency and savings. And we need to be smarter consumers of energy. With the advent of new technology, hybrid vehicles, we can reduce our energy consumption while also increasing our energy production. That's exactly the type of dynamic that we need right now to really help get our economy going.
You'd mentioned briefly the instability in the Middle East. There's a pending plan to deliver more fighter jets and tanks to Egypt. Where are you on that issue?
Well, the revolutions are going forward, and there's a lot of uncertainty in what path they're going to choose. And just because they overthrew some of the dictatorial rule that's been in place for many, many years doesn't necessarily it's going to mean a straight path to democracy and the type of individual rights that we equate that with. But I think, you know, we need to be careful in regards to where we're sending the weapon systems and who we're arming, because things can change quickly overnight. But it's also a tough neighborhood. I've been over there many times myself. Most recently, I was just back into Afghanistan and India last October, visiting with our troops in Afghanistan, but also having meetings with India, which could be a crucial ally in the region. It's an English-speaking democracy right in the hotbed of Al-Qaeda and a lot of those insurgent movements. And we're going to have to keep an eye on that. But without also neglecting the other fast-growing area of the world, and that's the Pacific Rim, and that's the Asian nations. And that's just a balance that we're going to have to strike.
Anything we haven't covered today?
No, I'm glad to be here. You know, we're going to be stopping over at New Page, doing a walkthrough and an update in what direction they're going into. I've been extremely supportive of the paper and pulp industry. I know it's one of the keys to jobs in this region, too, and hope to get back over to the university as well. They've got some interesting things there on undergraduate research that they want to show me on campus.
Congressman Ron Kind joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you.